Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 17 of the Handsome Timothy Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast you can find on iTunes. Just look for Dan and Travis. We are also a proud part of the Chronic Rift series of podcasts looking to bring the culture in pop culture over at chronicrift.com. I'm a little tired, it's because I just got back from the Austin Film Festival, which is wonderful and fantastic as always. We'll talk about more in the coming weeks. I want to thank everybody for listening, downloading, sharing, retweeting the pretty fantastic interview we had last week with Steve Sky. Keep sharing it, keep spreading the word. Lots of great wisdom in there. So here we are, the week of Halloween, All Hallows Eve. And, you know, talk about filmmaking and creativity and screenwriting. Got to talk about horror movies. One of the most fun, one of the most intriguing, one of the most interesting, one of the most analyzed. I don't know why I have to tell you, because everybody loves horror movies. And I'm delighted to welcome possibly one of the foremost authorities and experts on horror movies that I know. He is, just to give you some bona fides, he's an assistant editor who's worked on shows ranging from Shark Tank to The League to Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David. Yes, that Larry David, as well as WWE Legends House. He's one of my oldest and dearest friends. Welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Rick Dominicus.
Hi, Tim.
Awesome. So you own something like, I mean, I don't know, it would be hard to quantify, I think, your horror movie fandom. Just thousands upon thousands of horror movies, probably. And I figured you'd be a good guy to talk to about some horror movies to check out this Halloween week.
Well, I mean, it all depends on what you're looking for. I mean, everybody has different taste. Mm-hmm. And there's a wide range of stuff you can watch during the season. Some people like slasher movies. Some people like ghosts, like haunted house movies.
Sure.
Some people like really gory stuff. Some people like, you know, the horror comedy genre. There's a lot of different ways you can go. How do you want to go? Do you want to start with recommendations? I don't know how you want to. I'm new to the podcasting world, as if you can't tell.
No, that's okay. So am I. I'm only on my 17th show. One of the things that, you know, a lot of us who are within our group of friends, we have a horror movie screening, like people all over the country do this week. And one of the most fun things about it is you do drop some really ridiculous, horrible horror movies that nobody should ever watch. And,
I do dig into the archive a bit and try to find some stuff that's a little off the beaten path.
But there's also usually an interesting selection from some international stuff. And I was wondering, maybe we should start there with what some of the foreign horror movies, like, for example, you have a poster on your wall here of the movie Eyeball, which I remember enjoying quite a bit. It's a flawed movie, dear listener, if you've seen it.
Yeah, it's
but,
flawed. It's
but there is something very genuinely creepy about the concept, and I remember enjoying it very much. So what are some of the – and the other thing, too, is looking at shows like Resurrection, and I know there's a sister show similar to the concept. Some of these shows are borrowing from foreign horror movies. Looking at something like The Grudge, for example, which was remade. So
The Ring. There's a lot of – there was that time, I guess it was in the early 2000s maybe, when that was happening, where every other Japanese movie that came out was getting a remake. You know, there was The Ring, The Grudge, or not necessarily Japanese, but the Far East and stuff like that. There was stuff coming out. Was it The Call or something like that? I can't remember what it was, but I feel like every other weekend there was something that came out 5 years ago over there is now all of a sudden getting an American remake. And usually, with the exception of, like, the original remake of The Ring, they were all kind of terrible, unfortunately. But, let's see, foreign stuff. I actually have a list. There's some interesting stuff that, like, the French have gotten into making really violent movies in the last few years. They're stepping up their game a little bit in terms of their horror output. There's a movie called Martyrs that came out a couple of years ago, which is not a fun ride, but it gets very existential at some point during it. It's about a home invasion and a woman gets kidnapped and kind of locked in this very sterile basement. That's about as far as I'm willing to go with the description of it, lest I ruin the payoff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an intense ride. It's really well done. But it was one of those, it's like, it was recommended to me by somebody, and I said, it was one of those, like, after it was done, I just had to kind of sit in silence for about 20 minutes and go, what the I just see.
Wow.
There's another movie they did that came out called Inside that I watched recently. It came out in like 2008 or 9 or something like that, about another home invasion. Oddly enough, a pregnant woman is kind of stalked inside her home. That's another one that is absolutely terrifying, and very winds up being very grotesque at some point later in the movie too, which is kind of off-putting. But still, really, really tense, really well done, really well made. I feel like I need to find lighter fare for people to watch.
No, it's Halloween. No, well, one of the interesting things, though, the Arnold, when we had Arnold T. Blumberg, who's probably the only other person who knows as much, if not more, about horror than you do. So don't worry, Arnold. I didn't forget about you. He talked a lot about how horror, especially zombies and things like that, are very much tied into current events, not necessarily current events, but like the current zeitgeist and what people are tapping into people's internal spheres. And here you mentioned home invasion twice,
yeah,
which, you know, is one of those things.
There's been a lot of that, too, in the last couple of years.
When we think of identity theft, we think of personal violation. You know,
yeah.
Even when you look at these nude photo scandals that happened recently, the privacy is changing. The definition of privacy and violation is changing. It sounds like these movies are tapping into that fear.
Yeah, I mean, we have movies like The Strangers, which came out a few years ago, that movie with Liv Tyler.
Oh, yeah,
which is terrifying.
That's creepy.
It's all the more terrifying. I mean, the line is in the trailer. It's like, why are you doing this to us? It's like, because you were home. There's no other motivation. It's because we just want to screw with you. That is it. And that's more terrifying than anything else, than having any kind of other, like, grander motivations. Like, somebody just like, oh, they're home. Let's just go and see how badly we can terrorize these people.
Yeah, and going off that, like, we're still figuring out. I mean, looking at the Robin Williams suicide, which is still cast over our society to a degree. We're just coming to terms with things like mental illness. I mean, we're just starting to even think about slowly, maybe understanding certain mental illnesses. Like, we still don't understand serial killers. We don't understand why some people have this sociopathology, this psychopathology that leads to these horrible things that happen to us. Why is it you think these are terrifying concepts already? We're not even 10 minutes in, and this is we've started with some of what is it, in your opinion, makes somebody watch this and go, wow, this is really fun? I enjoy watching things like this.
I don't know. I mean, everybody's different. I mean, for me, I started watching stuff like this when I was maybe 12, 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I got into this, the horror genre as a whole. I got introduced to it actually through reading. I was lucky enough, I guess, to have, parents who were permissive, and I showed an interest in reading Stephen King's. Like, they were like the first books I pulled off the shelves. Like, well, if he wants to read them, at least he's reading.
Right.
So that was kind of my gateway drug into it. And, you know, I moved on to Clive Barker and stuff like that, and I started watching the movies that were based on these books, and that, you know, it kind of opened up the world to me. I saw Alien when I was really young, and it terrified me, but it was still interesting to me. So I wound up, you know, getting further and further into it and looking into more stuff. And for me, a lot of it's escapism.
Mm-hmm.
Just as, you know, and to challenge your own fear sometimes.
Mm.
It's, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, I'm terrified of heights. And
yeah, you won't find me and Rick doing that rope walk in Vancouver. We're not doing that. No,
nope.
we'll be at the fish seafood market waiting for you at the bottom.
Yeah, I'll be at the market. That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't need to, like, the
couple martinis and beers in.
Yeah, the what is it, like, the what's the thing at the Grand Canyon, the glass
walk? I don't know.
There's this glass walk at the Grand Canyon that's like, oh, it's clear and you can step on it and see all the way down. I was like, no, thank you.
Yeah, but like, I'll watch Cliffhanger.
Yeah,
it's terrifying. Terrifying.
Yeah, and I will be gripping.
I will
white knuckle that movie because I'm terrified that he's going to fall off the side.
So,
but there's a certain exhilaration to it, and there's also once I latched onto the idea that I wanted to get into working in TVs and movies, I watch them for the artistry because there's a lot of really talented people that work in that genre, and have been for, you know, since the horror movies started back at the beginning of, you know, making movies. There have been a lot of really talented people that work in that medium. So it's just going back and watching how they do things.
Yeah.
It's especially fun now watching, like, the new crop of horror filmmakers come out and see how they're, like, playing with old tropes or trying to... Because, I mean, horror movies have been made for... How long has cinema been around?
Yeah, since the beginning.
Since the beginning.
I mean, Nosferatu.
Right.
Is one of the great classic silent films.
Right. So, I mean, horror cinema's been around as long as cinema. So it's interesting to see how people reinterpret ideas or look at particular subgenres and stuff like that and try to make it their own. So I watch it on two different levels. Sometimes I just want something fun, like I'll go watch, you know, a bad 80s slasher movie just because it's kind of goofy and it's, you know, it's interesting. The effects are fun to watch or something like that. Or I'll sit down and I'll watch something like Martyrs. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like you just want to be challenged by something. It's like, okay, this is really going to take me on a journey that I would never, ever go on. Well, let's see what happens. And it might, you know, for some people it might be off-putting. And other people, for me, it's an intense experience, but at the end of it, I feel like I got something out of it.
Well, when we were watching, hanging out today with some friends, one of our good friends straight up said, I don't like scary movies. Because the comment came up, it's Halloween week, what's your favorite scary movie?
Yeah.
And one of our friends straight up, he said, I don't like scary movies. And it's, nobody really said anything. It's like, okay, you don't like scary movies, but it doesn't. This is a genre that doesn't speak to everybody, but there is a universality to it, if that makes a certain sense, of like, we want to be scared, especially as kids. I think kids...
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea. I read Stephen King in the 7th grade and The Shining, and I read Exorcist not that long afterwards. And it was very horizon-opening. Yeah. I think it's a good thing to sort of confront those fears as a young person. Yeah. Also, an understanding that, especially I think all young people need to be reminded that they're not invincible. But that's another that's another podcast for another story. Let's talk a little bit. We'll go back to some... obscure movies in a second, but I want to touch upon the new crop of filmmakers, what you just said, because in this day and age, we're now in the video-on-demand generation, and the production dollar today goes farther than it ever has, possibly in the last 50 years. So many people are making low-to-no-budget horror movies, and the way to do that is you can't do it with a bunch of special effects that cost $50 million. You have to sort of do it the old-fashioned way with suspense and just good old-fashioned filmmaking trickery. Are you finding that?
Well, I mean, there's, like every film genre, there's a lot of dreck out there. There's a lot of just like, oh God, this is terrible. Like people aren't even trying. But then you get, and when you find that good stuff, it's like, oh, they've got something. I love, there's been a little bit of renaissance in the last couple of years of the anthology film.
Mm-hmm.
The horror anthology has come back in a big way with movies like VHS and ABCs of Death and Trick or Treat, which is kind of, which came out 2008 or 2009, something like that, that sadly did not get a lot of play. It did really well on the festival circuit. Warner Independent was going to release it theatrically, and they just kind of botched the release, and then nobody saw it all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
It's great, because I watched ABCs of Death 2 three nights ago, whatever it was. And it's the concept of that is there's a filmmaker for every letter in the alphabet. They're all given a letter. It's like, okay, go off and make a short. Whatever you want to do. Complete free creative reign.
Whoa.
You've got letter A, you've got letter B, C, and so on down the line, all the way through Z. And so they have no restrictions is what they want to do. They just have to make something starting with whatever letter they're given, a word that starts with that letter, and that's it. So it's great to see what comes out of their heads.
Yeah.
And the first installment of that series was, for me, was kind of hit or miss. The second film was a home run. There were like maybe three out of the entire crop that were kind of like, it's okay. But man, it was almost like one after the other. It's like, man, that's really clever. That effect is really good. The way they took on this trope is fantastic, or whatever it is. There was something really interesting about every one of them that made them worth watching.
So these were all shorts that were combined into like one.
Yeah, the whole it's an anthology. It's like So it starts off with like they do everything. It's like it opens like with this. This particular one, it was like the pages of the book. It's like letter A.
Right, okay.
And the first film shows, and they're between, like, you know, they're 5 or 6 or 7 minutes long, depending. The entire movie altogether without the credits was like 1 hour and 53 minutes.
Wow, okay.
Like so it's tight storytelling.
Yeah.
Which is difficult to do.
Yeah.
And to do it well. It's often, sometimes I think, harder to tell a really good story in a short amount of time than it is to make something that's 90 minutes.
Oh, I said this to Megan on the sitcom when we talked about sitcoms. Give me a 6-hour miniseries and I'm in heaven. Give me 30 minutes in a sitcom. I'm like, oh my God, I'm just getting warmed up after 30 minutes, you know?
Yeah, so it's a challenge to actually do something well. I mean, you talked about the mental illness thing. There was one, the letter Y. I should look up the filmmaker, but I watched it on demand at home. And it got to the letter Y, and I'm watching it. It's like, it was kind of fun and really kind of out there in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a little girl in their apartment, and she's like writing like these kind of like evil text messages to post online about her stepfather, I believe it is, and her mother and stuff like that. And it starts off kind of fun and strange. It's like she's just thinking about these all the things and whatever to kind of get back at them. And then the story just kind of devolves into, it gets really serious when it takes a turn. And after it was over, I had to pause and sit.
Yeah.
And go, wow. It was really on it. Because the rest of, everything else was really well done. It was, you know, the things that were suspenseful needed to be suspenseful, and there was a lot of stuff that was over the top or whatever it was. But this one really struck home because it took something that seemed kind of fun in the beginning, just kind of like, ha ha ha, whatever, like a guy in a giant bear costume, there's a giant penis, and it's like this, all this really strange esoteric stuff, and then it gets down to it. Like,
yeah.
This is what's really going on. It's like, oh, shit. That was really horrifying. I had to sit and go, I had to, like, collect myself and watch it. Okay, now I can watch the last bit of it.
I think a lot of people would say, no, fuck Z, I'm out. But what's interesting, in so these were 26 different filmmakers that were combined to make the one movie. I wonder if any of them came up with, and I'm going to guess that the answer is no. And that's one of the interesting things about the horror genre, is if you give people, you lock 26 filmmakers and give them a similar thing, they're not going to come up with the same idea.
Oh, no.
So much of horror, I think, comes from, like you brought up your fear of heights and stuff like that. It comes from a deep personal confrontation of something that is personally scary to that filmmaker, you know, or the writer or the director, you know, and confronting that individual thing.
Yeah. My favorite thing about this resurgence of the anthology movie is that you get to be exposed to a lot of different talent that you might not necessarily see if they were trying to all, like if you took all 26 of those people and they all tried to get a feature made on their own.
Right.
Like maybe five of them might actually make that leap.
Right.
But in this case, it's like, oh, and there were people from all over the world. A guy from like Africa, Australia, England, you know, U.S., Canada, like Mexico. They were from all across the globe. These filmmakers were slapped together in one movie. It was great. It's a lot of fun.
And one of the things that's interesting about that is that you go around the world, there is a universality to us all, but there are different cultural things. Like we are just starting to deal with surveillance in the United States of America.
Yeah.
They've been dealing with surveillance in closed circuit in the UK for 20 years now. You know what I mean? So like the UK might incorporate some of those things earlier than we might, or we might incorporate some earlier than they might, vice versa, things like that. I remember you pointing at me to the movie, I think it was called Raw Meat with Donald Pleasance.
Yeah.
In the subway.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty crazy British movie. That's also a very conceptually chilling story.
Yeah.
About homeless people who are cannibals in the subway, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the British have a very different take on horror, too. I mean, you look at, like, Hammer Studios back in pretty much their whole run, they were doing, they're noted for their horror films, and they're a very particular type of horror, and it's something that I personally have a hard time getting into.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying, honestly. Hammer fans out there, I'm trying. I really am. I've watched 7 or 8 of them. I keep trying to find one that I can latch onto and say, yes, this is the one that I really love. Maybe it's just the period that they all tend to be set in, which is like that Victorian era kind of thing. That just like it makes it hard for me to get into it. But there are thousands and thousands of fans that people love, live and die by these movies, but they're a very particular type of horror. They did all of the Dracula films and
This is Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
Peter Cushing, and you know, they built a studio more or less on the back of these movies.
One story I'd love to bring up, and I know it's like one of the more famous ones, and I kind of want to talk more about some off-beaten path recommendations, but one story, I think, and the more I think about it, like, from a story sense, from, like, a screenplay sense, that I think is one of the most brilliant horror movies devised is Nightmare on Elm Street, like, the original. And that was a movie that also, like, tackled, you know, it took that teeny bopper, like, the teeny bopper teen movie.
Yeah.
If you took Freddy Krueger and the horror element out of it, you've got Pretty in Pink or Can't Buy Me Love. But Wes Craven said, to hell with that. I am going to put not just a monster in there, but what's so interesting was the twist of spoilers for everybody who's not seen Nightmare on Elm Street. Fast forward to the next minute or so. The fact that this town was a town of vigilantes, and these parents took justice in their own hands. And there's something that was so kind of intrinsically like John Rambo, Ronald Reagan, 80s about it, and that turned around and bit them in the ass, kind of. And it's an incredible. Some of the film, and Wes Craven's a brilliant filmmaker, some of it doesn't hold up compared to today's special effects. But I was at the edge of my seat every time I watch it, because it just is such a compelling concept.
Well, I mean, he took the concept from an article he read about, it was a story about a child, I feel like it was in Africa or something like that, that was so troubled by dreams that they wound up killing him.
Wow.
He died in his sleep because he was convinced that there was somebody after him that was chasing him while he was sleeping. And eventually it did, in fact, kill him. So Wes Craven kind of latched on that concept. It's like, okay, what if there was something that if you fell asleep and you dreamt about it, it could actually kill you in your sleep? And that's kind of where, that was his jumping off point with it.
Mm.
And Wes Craven's a guy that didn't grow up with television, was not allowed to go to the movies. Like, he lived a very kind of cloistered life growing up. And then he goes on to be this prolific horror filmmaker. I mean, he came out of the gate with, you know, Last House on the Left, which is one of the most notorious horror movies ever made, and, you know, hits a home run with Nightmare on Elm Street, and you go on from there.
But, well, something else that was happening in the 80s at the time, and I don't know if I'm 100% sure of this, the timelines. I know that there were several accused child molesters who were killed by a parent, a friend, what have you. There were several of those that happened. And it's an interesting exercise, I think, and I know that you'd be interested in something like this, which is to read the newspapers like 2 years before your favorite movie came out to see what is influencing some of these things. Because the people in Nightmare on Elm Street – and the thing was is some of these guys who killed these accused child molesters, they got off. They were acquitted because no jury is going to send a man who's protecting his family to jail. So this town sort of became like that. That was tied in the zeitgeist. I just find that I'm bowled over by that, the ingenuity that Wes Craven was able to bring into that. And he's another guy, too, that once you thought, well, he's all over. Well, he's all done. He's done it all. And then, boom, along comes Scream.
Yeah.
And he takes the whole genre.
And that was a movie that came out of nowhere. That was one of those that it got released pretty close to Christmas in the year that it came out.
It was 96, right?
96?
Yeah, 95, 96,
It came, you know, it was before Dimension Films really kind of like blew up for Miramax.
Right.
It was their first big hit, but it got a really small release, came out in a couple hundred theaters, kind of snuck into the market, and word of mouth propelled that movie into a hit. Again, they rolled it out in a couple more. It was one of those, like, slow rollouts that they used to have, like, in the 70s,
where
they'd release a movie, like, before Star Wars, and before you had your big tentpole movies, they would do, like, slow rollouts of movies. They would open in bigger cities first, and then gradually make their way to middle America and whatever, and Scream was kind of like that, because they weren't sure if it was going to be a hit. I mean, it tested well, it had a little bit of buzz, but nobody had really seen it. This was long before the internet was really a big thing, so there weren't people like, oh my god, I went to this test screening, and they're tweeting about it all over the place. There was no social media involved in it. It was just, it kind of, like, hit on its own. And it snuck up on people that it was such a, it snuck up on the studio that it was such a monstrous hit. So, but you never know. I mean, you might see, you know, he might come out with something again.
I wouldn't doubt it. If somebody said to me, Wes Craven's going to reinvent horror next year, I have no reason to argue.
Sure.
I remember seeing Scream at the Brattle in Boston, like a year after it came out. And like everybody in there, not everybody, but like the chatter in the movie theater was people who were like, well, I have to see this movie because everybody told me and I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
And everybody screamed at all the right places, and it was super effective. But Scream is also, and so is Nightmare on Elm Street in some regards. So is Halloween, which is simply the great low-budget slasher movie of all time. There's a comedy element to these movies. There's comic relief, sometimes overly done with the one-liners and things like that.
Yeah.
How important is comedy to a horror movie, if at all? Are they kind of, are these strange bedfellows, or is it just...
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there's room for levity in some of these movies, but it all really falls back on the intent of the filmmaker, too. It's like some people are just trying to make a movie that's going to terrify you relentlessly.
Yeah.
It's just going to keep coming at you and coming at you and coming at you. I mean, you go back and look at the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, Jesus.
There's barely like a little side joke in that movie. Even when they're just kind of like getting along in the van before they pick up the hitchhiker and shit starts to go down, there's not a lot to laugh at really in the beginning of that movie. That movie is basically there to terrify you for 90 minutes.
And it does.
And it does. It's still effective today. You sit down and you watch that movie. It was made in 1973, 74. You watch it now, 40 years later, 74, because the new, the 4K remaster just came out. God, it's been that long.
I think Toby Hooper feels.
Yeah, that's an incredible disc, by the way. Pick that one up. It's still terrifying. It still holds up. I mean, what was it? I screened it early on.
2003.
Yeah,
that was the first one you did.
And my friend Roxanne had never seen it
before. Oh, she was out of her skin.
And she was basically leaping off the couch
out of her skin.
And people forget, you know, I mean, you think about a movie called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you think it's going to be gory, and there's barely any blood
But what's crazy to me about Texas Chainsaw is scary the same way Deliverance is scary.
Yeah.
Because what it's about is not about a crazy man with a chainsaw. It's about, and we've all been to these places where you're driving through the woods, and you're driving around, and you see some, and you look around, and you're like, fucked up shit happens here. You just know it. You look around and you're like, this is a bad place and this is not somewhere. Please don't. The car cannot stop here. Their car can absolutely not stop here. And we all know those places, whether they're in every state, you will find them.
I've stopped in a couple of those places on my way across the country a couple of times, yeah, just driving. It's like, I should not stick around here for very long. Well, I am not.
Of course you did. You watched Martyrs for fun.
I mean, I'm clearly not welcome here. I should move on.
And
I should get gas and go.
But, like, I mean, for me, the thing that always scared me about Chainsaw was the barbecue. That was the thing that really scared me. Oh, come on in and eat some barbecue. Come on in and eat some barbecue. And then you find out, oh, my God.
Yeah, that was Lenny that used to work at the general store down the street, you know.
And that's what made it kind of chilling. A lot of people love the new Texas Chainsaw. And it's a brilliantly made film. It's a terrific film. I'm not trying to bash the filmmaker. But the choice they made to kind of over-stylize it, like, I felt that was a place I would never go to. I would never find that house. I would never find that woods. And for me, I was just not as scared of it. Whereas Chainsaw Massacre, that looked like roads in Jackson, New Jersey. It looked like roads in Gilroy, California.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sure, it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but when you watch it, it is informed by your frame of reference.
Yeah. It's very true. I mean, the remake there's been a rash of remakes in the last 10 or 15 years, whatever it's been. The remake of Chainsaw, the first one they did, not the subsequent sequels and prequels they did, was one of the better ones. I mean, it is very different than the original. It takes a different stylistic turn.
Absolutely
true. But
it's
still, it's effective in its own way, but it still doesn't top the original.
I think people should see it. Put it on your list. If you haven't seen the remake, I'm not saying don't see it. It's just, for me, I don't know if I agree with all the stylistic choices. And that's a fair enough... Filmmakers, don't be mad at me. It's a fair enough criticism.
Yeah, but at least it's, you know, at least it's taking something good and not souring it.
Right.
It's a good companion piece. It doesn't, like, it's not one of those remakes like, oh, God, why did you bother?
Right. Well, that's the thing. And that's really where a tip of the hat needs to go to those guys, because they did do a very different film.
Yeah.
And that's almost, if you're going to remake, put your own stamp and spin on it. Make something that's going to stand out on its own.
Yeah.
And I think they deserve credit for that.
Yeah. And you look at some of the best, there have been countless horror remakes over the years. But you look at the best ones that have come out. I mean, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right. The Thing is a remake. Yeah, people forget.
And Cronenberg's version of The Fly.
Oh, brilliant.
They are, the original films and the remakes stand on their own as good cinema. Because they take the same story, but they are so drastically different. And in both cases with Cronenberg and Carpenter, they modernize them enough that they were so different enough. It's just, they're still telling the same story, but they're still different enough that it's refreshing and it's interesting. They have
absolutely
a completely different take on it.
Absolutely. And it's also interesting. I just love seeing The Thing in Halloween. You know, when the kids sit down and watch The Thing from Another World.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, Carpenter's got his thing for Howard Hawks. He's a big fan.
We do have to talk about Halloween. And I think I watch it every year. I watch Halloween and The Shining. Kubrick uses the comic relief to some effect in The Shining with I think it's Wednesday, it says, the slate that comes up. I also watch Poltergeist, which isn't so scary, but I have a soft spot for Poltergeist. But every year, I've seen Halloween, I don't even know, Rick, like 30 friggin' times, and I still am in utter awe of it. And there's something about the just utter devotion to the commitment to the story that John Carpenter makes. And one of the things that's so brilliant about Halloween is it is what it is, and because of that, it becomes so much more.
Yeah,
almost.
It's not trying to be anything else but what it is. It's a scary movie about something that's, you know, again, we talk about home invasion and stuff like that. I mean, Michael Myers is kind of, I mean, basically that movie is him doing a home invasion. Like, he's breaking into people's houses, breaking into their cars, trying to murder them. It's the same kind of concept. It's a very visceral, it's a fear that people can latch onto.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are afraid of people coming up on the street, some stranger or whatever it is, just coming out of the night and violating them in some way.
Well, the other thing, too, that's interesting about Halloween, and this brings up a good point, and it sounds like a duh, no-brainer, there's nothing supernatural about Halloween.
Not until you get into the sequels now.
Right. But, like, if you just watch Halloween 1, There's nothing supernatural happening. Nope. That again, that it's Haddonfield, Illinois, with California license plates, but every
it's Pasadena,
but it's Jackson, New Jersey. It's Richmond, Virginia. It is any town, USA, and it's also tapping into what year was it? I know that the economic times were not great when it came out, 78. So there's still a I think the oil recession and stuff was still happening.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's that attack of suburbia, that attack of homes, that attack of your security. And I'm just – all the choices I think Carpenter makes are just absolutely perfect. And he'll probably be the first one to say, well, I wasn't doing anything that special. I was just doing shit that made sense. But that's why it's so that's why it works. Just it's like almost good old-fashioned lunchbox nuts and bolts filmmaking.
Yeah.
And it was shot in what, like 6 days or something crazy? Like
it was less than a month, I think they shot.
Oh, it's crazy. The actual principal photography was in a very short period of time. So they didn't have time to be super fancy. And when you watch it, it just doesn't have to be.
No, I mean it's very he shoots it in anamorphic. He shoots in very wide frames, so he can capture a lot while he's shooting, and he gets a lot done with very little.
Yes.
That's the best part about it. And like it's very economical filmmaking,
yeah.
Which is what a lot of independent filmmakers need to do. They need to think, okay, I've got this concept. I need to be able to bring it in with the resources I have. How small does this need to be in order to make it work? Or rather, how big can I go? Like, what's the limit? And shoot within this. It's like, okay, I'm going to make it work in this with these little pieces I've got and pull something off.
And he basically, you know, wrings every second of terror out of that towel.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, too, like, watching that time, because I think Halloween and Alien came out similar years.
Halloween was 78, Alien was 79.
But, you know, there's such a similar shot in the end of the heroine trapped in a closet, seemingly overpowered, and finds a way out. But I think there's something about – I tried to write a horror movie a couple years ago, and I wasn't super successful at it because I had, like, two good scares, maybe three. But Halloween – Carpenter committed himself so much to the scare, and I think that's what I would say to any young, if you're out there listening and thinking about a low budget, no budget horror movie, what's something you could piece together that you could try to make for $500,000 or less? Just go for scaring the shit out of people. Just get as many possible scares as you can, because you can't do that with not a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of Carpenter is he preys on primal fears, but he also takes the Hitchcock route, which is just building tension.
Mm.
There's so much of that movie where it's just We're building.
Yeah.
The little tinkling of the piano. You see, like, she sees Michael outside the window. It's just like, you don't really get to the crescendo until you're within the last 10 minutes of that movie. Not a whole lot happens.
Right.
Really physically happens, violently happens, until the last, you know, maybe half hour of that movie. You've got an hour of buildup, really, before really shit starts to hit the fan.
Yeah.
And that's great, because you get to spend time with the characters, you get to know them, you know their personalities, you see how they interact, and...
Yeah, she'd rather go with Ben Tranter.
Right, yeah, Ben Tranter.
Ben Tranter.
She loves Ben Tranter.
It's so interesting you say crescendo, because I'm sure that the Carpenter's style of filmmaking, and Big Trouble Little China, I think, has the same way, too, building up toward Egg Shen and Lo Pan's final confrontation, and looking at many of his most successful films, and even The Thing, which has a big, you know, this is a guy informed by his music. This is a composer as well.
Yeah.
And so there is actually, he's not the most advanced director, and he'll be the first one to tell you that. But there's a rhythm and a heartbeat to every Carpenter film, I believe. And I think that's helped by his composing skills. I think he's desperately underrated. You know, I don't think he's really appreciated enough.
For his style, I would say. I mean, he's known for his subject matter. He has been, you know, unfortunately to a certain extent, pigeonholed as a horror filmmaker, but he does have talent that extends beyond that. I mean,
yeah. Memoirs of an Invisible Man is so underrated.
Never seen it.
Oh, dude, it's so good. But it's so good.
But Starman is an incredible incredible love story.
Yeah.
You know, put into this little like sci-fi movie, but it's a compelling and really kind of heartbreaking love story, and it's so well done.
Yeah.
But he never gets a lot of credit for that. Because that came out in, 83, 84, and it's kind of like in the middle of its filmography between, you know, horror movies and stuff like that. So, I mean, he got a little bit pigeonholed, which I think is unfortunate. I mean, it's great that he's acknowledged as a good filmmaker in that one genre, but he has talent that lies beyond that.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Okay, let's talk about some more, since we just talked about the big hitters there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some more what are some other obscure or off-the-beaten-path movies we could recommend to people?
Well, I mean, we've been touching on the subject of newer filmmakers, and there's a guy I really like called Ty West, He's got three features under his belt. He kind of like broke onto the scene with this movie called House of the Devil, which is kind of a throwback to mid to late 70s horror movies. It's set in the era. I think it's more like late 70s, early 80s. It's set in that time frame, that time period. And it's such a simple story. It's about a girl who gets hired to babysit at this kind of weird house down the road. And it's another one. It's all about atmosphere. There's scares, and when they happen, they're potent. But it's a lot about atmosphere and building tension and the creaking in the house and this little thing and this and that. It's really well done. He followed that up with a movie called The Innkeepers, which is a pretty good ghost story. It has there were a couple things in it. There were some questionable choices, I thought, anyway, about certain things that happened. But overall, again, that movie was a lot about atmosphere and about, you know, again, it takes place at like a seaside hotel that's on the verge of closing. And it's kind of like the night crew that's the last of the employees are working there. And they feel like it's haunted, so they've decided to set up cameras around to see if they can catch this specter that's haunting the hotel. It's really effective and really well done. He released a movie, I guess it came out earlier this year, called The Sacrament, which got some really good buzz.
Yeah, it got
festivals.
A lot of buzz.
I loved it. It was great. It took the found footage concept and really kind of elevated it, because it used Vice magazine as a framing device, where it was these guys were a documentary crew, and they were making a documentary for Vice, and they go down to visit this kind of a commune that one of the guy's sisters has gone off and decided to make a life there, and they're going down to talk to her and see what's going on, and maybe, you know, kind of on the sly, like, get her, it's like, hey, you want to come back home kind of thing, and it's expertly done, and it starts off really slow, and you kind of get into it, and you're getting the feel of the lay of the land, and you get to meet the leader of this you know, this little utopia they're creating, and then it just starts to all kind of spiral out of control, and it is fantastically done, really tense, one of the better horror movies to come out easily in the last 5 years.
Wow!
But the problem is that not a lot of people have seen it, because it didn't get a lot of advertising, didn't get a lot of play, but it's worth seeking out.
Yeah, seek it out. Let's get Ty West some buzz here, listeners.
He's also done some shorts. He did a short in the original VHS anthology. Let's see, who else is out there? There's the Soska sisters, who are out of Canada.
Oh, yeah. They just did See No Evil 2 for
right,
WWE.
That's premiering at, or the premiered at the LA Horror Film Festival or something like that.
But they're getting a ton of buzz.
They're getting a ton of buzz.
Him.
Their first movie, Dead Hook in Her Trunk, is interesting. You can see that they're kind of like honing their craft in that movie. You can see that there's talent there. It's kind of, for me, it's kind of uneven, but it's worth watching just because they're interesting characters, these ladies. And they came back, they followed that up with a movie called American Mary, which I love, which is about a woman who goes to medical school and eventually just kind of falls out and starts doing surgery on the side to kind of pay her bills.
As you do.
But it's a really well-crafted and really, really well done horror film, and these ladies clearly have a lot of talent, and they're starting to make a name for themselves with that. And they did See No Evil 2. They just got hired to do Painkiller Jane.
Oh wow!
They're up and coming. They're worth keeping an eye on. They're really talented.
I want to talk about atmosphere for a second, though. Do you think one of the things that drives me crazy, and I'm not going to name the films, but you could probably do the math, when I see a horror movie and the trailer, or a horror movie trailer, and the trailer builds toward a special effect, I am probably not going to see that horror movie. And I'm saying this with love, because one of the things that I think horror needs to be effective at, you talked about found footage, and playing with these devices. Like, we have not talked special effect at all in the past 40 minutes, and I don't think we have to. Horror is at its best when you are totally bought in to what you are seeing, and you, like, for example, the people seeing The Exorcist in 1975, or when it was 75, right, I think, 73, when it came out, were watching that going, how the fuck did they turn her head around? You don't want to know how they do this. I think everybody knows the remake of The Haunting was very unsuccessful as a film, and one of the reasons why is because I'm watching it going, well, that's a computer effect.
Yeah.
Can't immerse myself into the movie. Would you say atmosphere is more important than special effects and maybe even gore?
To a certain extent. It also, again, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure.
In terms of CGI, it's hard for me, as someone who grew up with physical effects and stuff like that, to find CGI scary. It's got to be really, really solid and
yeah.
to get to me.
Yeah, it's got to be CGI that is, like, the realist. Like, in other words, you're doing something.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be a level of, if it's, especially if it's cheap CGI, it's like, it's disappointing, it's not scary.
Well,
but, I mean, atmosphere, I think, is important in a horror movie, no matter what you're doing. Because you need to be able to build at least a little bit of tension before whatever happens, be it somebody gets stabbed in the face, or, like, something jumps out of the shadows, whatever it is. I feel like you need to have, there needs to be an air of tension.
Yeah.
Somehow, however you're getting it across, be it, it's, you know, how you're photographing it, the location, the situation, whatever it is, there should be, that's important no matter what. If you're going, again, it's what you're going for. If you're trying to make a gory slasher movie, then your effects need to be on.
Yeah, sure.
Need to be solid.
I'm not trying to pigeonhole it, because a movie like Saw, for example, which is just total gore porn, is obviously going for something. Well, I'm not trying to, I don't say that in a bad way. It is what it is. I mean, it is an extraordinarily gory movie. Human Centipede is an extraordinarily gory movie.
Yeah.
So that's a different experience than The Haunting, the original Haunting, which is almost all aural effects.
Yeah, it's a lot of sound, it's a lot of, you know, different camera angles and stuff like that. It's what you don't see.
Right.
And it's also, with the original Haunting, it's a lot of what the characters are doing to each other, too. It's the conversations they're having that build tension in the room, so.
Psychological and things like that.
It's a very different, that's a case where a remake is very different from the original, but goes the wrong way.
Right.
I'm trying to think of, like, stuff I've seen that has a lot of effects work and stuff like that. And
it's really hard to think of a horror movie that's packed with effects that you're like, wow. Like, I mean, Poltergeist, I mentioned, is packed with effects.
Right.
And to the point of almost, it gets a little silly at times. I mean, but at the same time, it was a PG movie. It was meant for kids.
Well, what Poltergeist has going for it is a very human story.
Absolutely.
Before anything really crazy happens in that movie, you get to know that family. And you buy in to them, the kids, the relationship with the mother and father. You buy into all that. And then stuff starts happening slowly.
Yeah.
A chair just goes across the room. And it's like, oh, it's kind of fun. We have a specter in the house. There's this weird little thing happening. And then, an hour into that movie, after you spent all this time with these people, then things start to get bigger. The effects start getting bigger.
Yeah,
the guy starts pulling his face
which
off.
Which is great.
Worm,
I love
the
that one.
Out of the steak. You know,
it's the giant mouth in the end.
The giant skull that comes out of the thing. You know,
that stuff's fine. I just, there's always the big mouth in the end. I was like, that's where I have to willfully suspend a bit. But at the same time, if you're bought in, you're bought in.
Yeah,
at that point of the movie,
you're in. At that point, you want them to rescue Caroline from the other side. You want them to pull her out.
You've said, I think, that Act 1 of Poltergeist is the best Act 1 of a horror movie you may have seen.
Yeah, it's one of the best written horror movies, period. Yeah.
And that's another one. That's everyday America. It's neighbors watching football.
It could be your kids
going to school, putting a pool in.
You live in a, it's an all suburban neighborhood. It's very relatable.
Yeah.
And that, I think, helps. When you have things that are really too otherworldly, it's maybe hard for people to connect with it.
Yeah. Are we getting away from that? Do we have horror movies these days amongst these new crop of filmmakers that will put in? Listen, I'm going to open a movie that's going to look like a Nicholas Sparks movie. And then I am going to unleash a fucking zombie out of the closet and is going to scare the shit out of all the teenagers. I worry we're not doing that, and maybe we should be. Maybe you and I should start writing that as soon as we wrap the show, you know?
I feel like there's a lot of potential out there. There's a lot of good talent. There's a big talent pool now. And they grew up with...
Carrie's another one that does that.
Yeah, the original Carrie is very good. It's very Holmes Bond.
Yeah.
Very, looked very relatable. I mean, the remake, again, not necessary. It's like... That's what I don't understand. I'm going to go off on a rant about remakes for a second.
so did Ron a couple episodes ago, no worries.
Remakes have been around as long as Hollywood's been around. Remakes are not new. There may be more of them now, maybe, than there used to be. But they were very common, even in, like, the 30s and 40s. They were remakes of movies that were made 2-3 years before that. They would just add a new title, get a new cast, kind of sell it as a new movie. Not really talk about the attachment it had to that it's a remake or whatever, but they would put it out on the market anyway. Bruce's Millions has been made, like, 4 times. It's like, it's not new.
I didn't know that.
There's so much. I mean, if you're gonna build something on remaking things, there are a ton of movies that have interesting concepts, but maybe didn't get pulled off quite well. I feel like those are more ripe for a remake than, say, something that is. But, and I understand the mentality around it. People are trying to make money. It's like, oh, this is a brand. We can build on it. This is why there's been an Evil Dead remake. This is why there's been Texas Chainsaw remake. It's like, people know this.
Money,
we can sell it again.
Yeah, it's all about money.
Yeah, that's all about money. And I understand the economics of it. People want to make money. I get it. But there's something to be said about finding something that's maybe a little off the beaten path. Like, oh, that's kind of got an interesting story, but it was done on such a low budget that it doesn't really come across, or it's kind of a crappy movie, it was poorly cast, whatever it is. Take those smaller concepts and build upon them. You can maybe make something better from an older movie that was maybe not so great, but had a good idea, and blow it up. Maybe, you know.
Raw Meat would be ripe for that. Raw Meat's pretty good. Well, I mean, like, imagine if Peter Jackson made Crawl.
Sure.
That'd be fantastic.
Especially now.
You know? Yeah. So, Peter, you're in post, so when you're done, go make some Crawl.
Yeah. Actually, go back to making smaller movies. Make another Heavenly Creatures.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another brilliant movie. And again, chilling, so.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about, we're about 46. We're coming up on time a bit. Let's talk some more recommendations, some more, what else can people seek out?
Well, I tried to dig, you gave me the idea of like trying to dig into find some stuff that's a little off the beaten path. If you're looking for something a little more fun, that you know, there's you can dig into if you want to go in the early 80s, there's something called April Fool's Day.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great. Which is, yes.
That's an interesting one.
And it doesn't get a lot. I mean, it gets kind of buried in that slasher genre.
And it shouldn't.
And it shouldn't. It's really well done. It got remade a couple years ago and it was terrible. But find the original from like 1981, 82. I think it came out right after, right on the heels of the first Friday the 13th movie.
Yeah, Biff is in it. Tom Wilson.
Tom Wilson. And it's a strong movie. And it's
scary.
It's really well done.
Twists it on your head a little bit.
There's a whole, you can, if you're looking for something a little more modern, Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which Alan Tudyk is in it. That did okay when it came out. That's more in keeping with, it's kind of got a tone that's more like Shaun of the Dead, which is kind of fun. It's just like these couple of bumbling like rednecks like stumble into this, you know, it's worth seeing. Just, it's very funny and very, you know, over the top. Cabin in the Woods is also a good one to check out, which I think more people have seen now that it's hit home video, but that one just kind of buried.
Yeah, that's got a lot of good, but I've heard good things about that.
I mean, if you want to go back into, you want to go back to like the 50s and stuff like that, you can't go wrong with picking anything off the shelf that William Castle did. If you're looking for something that's kind of fun, like House on Haunted Hill, which was another terrible remake ruined by CGI. House on Haunted Hill, The Tingler, 13 Ghosts, stuff like that. Those are kind of fun.
Yeah, the 13 Ghosts remake.
Again.
So much effects. So much effect. And it was not a bad idea, not a bad story, but
yeah, and again, it was one of those movies that's kind of fun for its time, but you know, hampered by the low budget or whatever. But the remake, again, they went way
over the top.
Way too far. Yeah. There's something to be said for subtlety. If you're looking to get kind of a Christmas haunt on, there's a movie called Rare Exports out of Norway. I believe it came out a couple of years ago about a kind of like vengeful Santa Claus, which is kind of fun. There's Dead Snow, which is, I think that's also Norway, about people get trapped in a cabin and are assaulted by Nazi zombies that rise out of the snow.
Sure.
Which is kind of fun.
No, that's definitely Norway. Well, Norway was also a forgotten front. Well, not by Norway or Europe, but in America, we often forget that Norway was one of the, was also a front in World War II.
Yeah.
And there were 4 years, 5 years of very intense fighting between Norway and Germany. Where would you put something like The Host?
That one actually made my list, too, of things to recommend.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best monster movies to come out in, I mean, as far as I can remember, in, you know, recent memory.
And I mean, topical as hell.
Yeah, absolutely. It's scary on a level that's different, I guess, than a lot of stuff that comes out now. Forget about the horror element. It's just a solid monster movie.
And it makes sense. Yeah. Like, it's one of those things that, again, you could watch it and go, like a Halloween. You know, that's one of the things that William Friedkin talked about all the time with The Exorcist is, look, it's a real house. You know these people.
Yeah.
This is not fancy, like you said, otherworldly. The Host could happen. I have no doubt the host could absolutely happen.
Yeah.
With what we're doing to the planet, it's a very thinly veiled anti-climate change movie.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even think it's veiled. I think it's a definite anti-climate change movie. And like, hey, this is what might happen if we keep fucking around with this stuff. Something I was going to say about remakes, I forgot for a second. And, you know, Ron Greenfield and I talked a little bit about this a few episodes ago, which is, you know, when movies come out at a certain time, one of the things that makes a movie hit is the time in which it comes out. I don't know if you could take Halloween and release it now. I think you could make a movie like Halloween. I think we're always going to be making low budget horror movies. We're always going to be making low budget slasher films, and thank goodness, and I hope we are. But there are certain movies that have to hit at a certain, like Psycho, is not going to work outside of that time period, because the whole thing about Psycho that made it scary was the fact that it was so much of it was so taboo.
Yeah,
her wearing a bra was a point of controversy with the studio. She had to wear a black bra because evil ladies don't wear white bras.
Yeah.
Give me a break. You know, I mean, talk about a changing time.
Well, I mean, you look at some of the best horror movies that come out of periods that were transitional.
Yes.
In history. You look at, like, especially the original, like, Universal horror movies came out of, you know, they were coming on the heels of war and stuff like that.
Yeah, Arnold and Blumberg talked about this as well. Yeah, absolutely right.
You look at the stuff that was starting, that started to come out in the late 60s and into the 70s during the Vietnam War, and plus at that time was kind of the dissolution of the studio system, and all that stuff just kind of fell away.
Yeah.
Where you started to get, you were kind of on the cusp of the MPAA coming into play. It was kind of like it turned into the Wild West, and Hollywood was like, oh, nothing's really taboo anymore. We can make whatever the hell we want.
Yeah.
And filmmaking equipment was becoming a little bit cheaper. There were a lot of radio filmmakers coming out, shooting stuff on 16 and Super 8, and you know, some of them would shoot on 35 and not very many, but you were getting stuff out in theaters, even if they were in smaller markets. You could release stuff kind of regionally, and they would get play. They would get on drive-house and drive-in circuits and stuff like that, where it's similar to what's happening now, where equipment is more accessible.
Yeah.
People are able to fund things a little bit easier. They can do stuff on the cheap and still make something fairly effective. And at this point, now with the internet, you can kind of self-distribute and get your stuff out there now. It's like, look, I'm all over YouTube, or I'm all over Vimeo, or whatever. Watch my movie here, watch my movie there. And you don't have to necessarily get theatrical distribution to be successful or to make something good anymore.
Absolutely right. And I think with the internet, I think we're coming across an age with this digital era, we're learning how much we actually don't know. And what I mean by that is, you know, the internet is the sum of all human knowledge, and it is also an enormous fountain of misinformation.
Yeah.
And that misinformation, be it conspiracy theories, be it Fox News, be it whatever fact-twisting we want to do, I think is going to be the next front for many horror concepts, if not already. That's just a personal guess. I think that there's going to be, and I don't mean like horror coming out of the internet. Like, it's very difficult, I think, to tie horror into computers and technology. That's always been successful.
It's never stopped people from trying, but.
But I think what I mean to say is we still have got what is in that house over the hill. There are still those houses out there. There are still those unknowns out there. Yeah. There are still those things we're learning out there. There's still those things we're finding, you know. Rob Zombie's movies are interesting, The House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects, because it was one of those things of, he played on the idea of, oh my God, look what we found in this house. What this has been happening for years. You know, like the first 10 minutes of Devil's Rejects, the police just like, oh my Christ, what in the world is this that we didn't know about? Nobody had a clue.
Well, Rob Zombie is one of those guys that grew up with in a similar time
that
we did, and his movies harken back very much to those like mid-70s movies and stuff like that were the Chains of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that kind of stuff, where he's pulled a lot of influence from those movies, and he's grown as a filmmaker. I in particular like Lords of Salem more than I think the rest of the world seems to like it. I read reviews of this movie all the time. It's like, what the hell is this?
Oh, no, that's
like,
very popular.
It's very atmospheric. It's very interesting. I haven't seen it since I saw it in theater, but it stuck with me.
Mm. That's probably the best compliment you could give it.
But it's one of those things that I keep needing to rewatch, just because the last like 15 minutes of that movie, I was just sitting in the theater. I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on, but I love it.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening here. This is so bizarre and out there, but I love what I'm seeing.
Mm.
And I'm still trying to figure out what happened. I need to watch it again from the beginning to see if I missed something along the way, or if this was just the natural progression, whatever it was.
Well, he's one of my favorite filmmakers, and or his favorite musicians. I love Rob. I've loved. I don't think I have a Rob Zombie song I don't like. Yeah. His films, though, are very, very not always successful. I'll be the first one they are polarizing. I'm not the biggest fan of House of a Thousand Corpses, but what's interesting about what Rob Zombie does, no matter what, and it's kind of like what you just described. He's the type of artist, and I do use that word on purpose. He's the type of artist who knows all the rules and will break every single one of them.
Yeah.
And he's not just doing it just to do it. He will absolutely break every single rule and just put everything and anything he believes should be in the picture will go in the picture.
Yeah.
And in that regard, he's a very brave filmmaker, even if it's not always successful. You know, I mean, he's a hero of mine, so if he hears this, I'm not shitbagging him, but I don't always agree with his choices. But he is that artist who will say, I know all the rules of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so my version is going to be all over the page.
He stands behind his work. He's an interesting man to listen to.
Intelligent guy.
I particularly enjoy his cut of Halloween 2 that he made, of his sequel. The theatrical version is awful. The cut that got released on home video, I think, is pretty stellar.
Yeah.
And to listen to him talk about it and how what he got into while he was making it and what he was trying to accomplish, he put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah.
He didn't want to kind of half-ass a sequel. It's like, okay, if you're going to make a sequel this late, because originally he didn't want to do it. He was just going to do the first one, just like, I got this out of my system, I'm going to be done with it. And when he heard they were trying to make a sequel, he's like, all right, if you're going to make one, let me step in and let me do what I want with it. And he got to shoot what he wanted, but it didn't get released the way he wanted. So he was able to come back and put like 35 minutes back into the movie. It's a very different film.
Wow.
And it's much stronger for it, I think. And it's overlooked because everybody saw it in the theater. It's like, oh, this is crap.
Yeah.
This is terrible. It's like 89 minutes of direct. And like the 2-hour-long version is actually pretty solid and has a lot of like impressionistic stuff in it and really kind of really strange things. He was like, he was trying to step beyond the normal slasher movie, makes it a little bit different that stood out.
Yeah.
And he accomplished that in his cut. It's a shame that a lot of people never give it the chance because they saw the butchered version in theaters.
Well, I'll put a link below. So,
there's one other movie I want to mention.
Please.
This Korean film called I Saw the Devil it's about a cop who's tracking a serial killer. It is absolutely amazing. It's like 2.5 hours long, but it is fantastic. It cooks, and it is terrifying. There's great character development. Yeah. It's incredibly, incredibly well done. Really, really smart filmmaking. Really well done. It stands out as one of the best horror movies of the last 10 years.
Wow. And
again, since it's, you know, foreign language, it does, you know, it got limited distribution in the States, but you can get it on home video. Magnet Releasing, I think, put it out on DVD and Blu-ray. It's worth seeking out. It's really, really good. If you're looking for something that's on par with, like, A Silence of the Lambs or something like that, it's up there in that territory. It's really, really well done.
So, I'm going to put you on the spot. I didn't warn you about this question.
Oh, Jason.
The readers and listeners, let's say one of them, they have only time for one horror movie this season. Which one do they watch?
That's tough because I got asked what's your favorite horror movie this afternoon. I never answered the question because I couldn't narrow it down.
But if you were to say to somebody like, listen, hey, dude, I only got time for one horror movie. Which one should I watch? There's no wrong answer. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's no wrong answer. And it's like the stuff that jumps to mind is some of the stuff that we've talked about already in this podcast. And I would gauge that. I would qualify that as just like whoever's asking me that question, I would think, oh, how well do I know you and what would I thrust upon you to watch?
Well, if you want to split it up by genre,
you
know.
If you just want to watch something kind of gory and fun, but also foreign, which is also a weird qualifier, but whatever. See if you can dig up Lucio Fulci's Zombie, which is kind of the granddaddy of the modern zombie film.
Okay.
It was made in 1980. The discs that are out in the States are pretty good. The best disc, if you can find it, came from Arrow Video in the UK. They did a ground-up restoration from the original negative. It looks beautiful. I got a region hack for my Blu-ray player just so I could watch it.
Yeah.
It's a spectacular restoration, but even if you don't get that fully restored version, the disc that's out from Anchor Bay is still good. It's a kind of a wonky transfer, but the entire movie's there. It's still watchable.
Don't get me started on region coding either. I will never be region coded again. I'm only region free.
Yeah, I'm trying not to be. It's opened up a whole new world of things that I can order from overseas. So I mean, if you got to pick a zombie movie, the Lucio Fulci's Zombie is the way to go. I would recommend American Mary as something to watch. That's well-crafted and very modern in its sensibilities. I love I Saw the Devil. What else have I got on my list here of things to watch? I would recommend ABCs of Death 2 if you want to see a variety of stuff.
Yeah.
And get, like, a lot of quick bits of interesting material. You can't go wrong with picking a Vincent Price movie, I don't think.
That's true, yeah.
If you want to have something that's kind of fun, you know, his entire filmography is filled with a bunch of gems. I mean, you can just grab, you know, throw a dart and grab whatever one that is and have fun with it.
One movie we watched one year on the horror movie stuff, and I got to mention it, and it is fun, and I think we were supposed to make fun of it, but I thought it was really great, was Night of the Creeps.
Oh, Night of the Creeps is great. Fred Decker? It's fantastic.
So great. It is so great. I love that fucking movie.
It's so much fun. And again, it's
so fun, but also, again, chilling. And we're talking about invading space slugs. That's not...
Yeah, I mean, it preys on the same kind of fears that Invasion of the Body Snatchers does. But, I mean...
But I just love him daydreaming in the he's sitting on the beach and this super hot woman comes out in the bikini and starts to rub his shoulders and then the phone rings and he's back in the office. He's like, God damn it. Yeah. I'm like, oh, this movie's awesome. I'm in.
It's a fun take on the 50s era monster movie. I mean, this is not a horror movie, but I mean, I love Joe Dante's Matinee, which is a kind of a love letter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Excuse me, which is a love letter to Wayne Castle and stuff that his entire output.
Well, I think these movies are good to inspire. I mean, it's also so personal. You know, we talked about being scared of cliffhanger. Some movies that some people are gonna watch and go, nope, can't do it, can't do it. I will not ever watch From Beyond again. Whereas some of the rest of us might watch From Beyond and laugh at it a little bit.
I haven't seen that in a while.
That movie's fucked up.
Yeah,
that
I mean, they're
so fucked up. Look, it's awesome. It's so awesome. Watch it twice.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, look, so I guarantee there is stuff that I could recommend that I even have trouble watching. There's some stuff out of Japan that I've seen, or whatever. It doesn't even matter what part of the world it came out of. There's some really kind of off-putting stuff out there that just is not for everybody. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend Human Centipede to everybody.
No, I'm not watching that.
But I've seen it. I've seen it twice because I find it fascinating. Yeah. It's awful.
I will watch it.
It's awful and grotesque and horrifying, but again, it's like it's pushing a boundary, which I thought was like there aren't a lot of people that are really pushing boundaries anymore, at least that in what I've been able to dig up anyway.
But see, I still like. I mean, it's funny because if somebody asked me that, what horror movie think I should watch, I would say The Exorcist.
Yeah, The Exorcist is always a good standby. But Halloween is always a good standby.
But if they said, "Oh, Exorcist too gory, I can't watch," I heard about it, it's too gory, then I would either say Halloween or the original Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, the original Night of the Living Dead is a good way to go. But again, that's, there's some gut munching in that movie.
It's not
shy about its,
But like Halloween and Halloween's got some gore in it too. I mean, Halloween is not,
Halloween's not devoid of it.
But there's something just so conceptually scary about those movies.
And, I mean, you can look at Rosemary's Baby, which is another classic. But again, it has kind of a far-out concept, but it... ingrains it in a very relatable kind of a situation. And it also preys on that fear of privacy.
The inclusion. And also, until the last minute, you really don't know what's happening.
What's going on. Yeah.
It really is. And it was very interesting to watch that movie
with
Megan. Because she's not super into horror movies, but the whole time she's like, wait a second. No, she was hallucinating. No, wait, she's crazy. No, wait, she's really... Wait a second. What? Like, and that is just a really good, like, horror mystery type thing.
It's a great update of Gaslight, which was a kind of a psychological horror movie from the early part of 1940s, I think it came out. Really, really strong stuff. That's something I would recommend. Go back and watch Gaslight. Gaslight is great. Again, that's all psychological. There's gore. It's early Hollywood, so there's really not a lot of gore.
The Haunting, too. I don't know. I keep going back to movies. I'm not the biggest fan of gore, really, I guess now that I think about it. Because a lot of my favorite horror movies... But, I mean, I love Hellraiser. I love Nightbreed. Nightbreed's a fucking wonderful fucking movie.
I actually watched I got an early copy of his director's cut on Blu-ray. Yeah. I watched it last night. It's a better film.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that it's perfect. It still has flaws that I feel like the theatrical version had, but it was all stuff. It's all setup stuff I feel like is missing.
Yeah.
But on the whole, a much, much better film. And adheres to his vision, which I think is important too.
But I go back to and again, maybe it's that word you kept saying, atmosphere. And maybe that's the thing that seduced me with my favorite horror movies is an atmosphere.
And you have to kind of set up the world too.
Yeah.
It's like you can't just dropping people into something they don't understand You have to be able to get. You have to be able to engage people right away, and at least have something that's a little bit familiar, even if it's set in space or whatever it is. There still has to be a relatable element to draw somebody in.
Well,
story.
That's a good point. You're segueing right into another movie, if you're a sci-fi fan and you want a scary movie, is Event Horizon.
Yeah.
And that movie holds up. And what I thought, remember watching that in the theater, and Lawrence Fishburne's the captain of the ship, and Sam Neill is the egghead scientist and all that. And I remember watching it going, they're not even trying to change the Star Trek conventions of a spaceship. They're not even trying to. It's and it literally is almost like, nope, they're waking up just like an aliens.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of sucks. And then you realize once the movie gets going, you're like, oh, yeah, fuck that. We're actually doing that on purpose because they were doing what you just described, which is setting up the familiarity so that you are immediately like, oh, I know these people. I know this world. I know what's happening. Oh, his skin is calling. It's being ripped off. Oh, shit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well that can backfire too because if it's too familiar, it can turn people off. It's like, oh, I've seen this in another movie. It's like, then it disengages your audience. That happens to me sometimes where I'll be watching something. It's like, oh, this is too familiar. This is set up. Like,
but you've seen everything.
Movie. Well, I haven't seen everything.
You've seen everything.
I've seen a lot. I haven't seen everything.
You've
but
seen,
I've
seen all the horror movies.
I don't know. What else is out there? There's plenty. I mean, you can dig into the 80s and find something fun in a bunch of different genres. You can watch stuff like Witchboard and Evil Speak. And like the 80s was kind of like a real... was like the heyday for horror movies, as far as I'm concerned, because there was just every weekend there was something new coming out. They were making it on the cheap, and they were all kind of fun in some way or another.
Yeah.
Everybody was trying to outdo each other with makeup effects and stuff like that. So if you're really looking for like good effects work, I feel like the 80s is where it's at, because that's when everybody was trying to one up each other.
Yeah, it was an arms race.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason we have a makeup effects Oscars, because American Werewolf in London.
Oh my God. Geez, and that's one of my favorites, and I didn't even think of that yet. Because
yeah.
I barely even think of that as a horror. I just think of that as a great, great movie.
But that's a horror. It's kind of a horror
comedy.
It's
absolutely a horror. That one is also as interesting in the sense of that's also a horror tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, and there are a lot of these horror movies are actually bona fide tragedies where the hero doesn't win. The hero does end up getting killed.
The
devil
lot
does win in a lot of these horror movies, you know, and not just for sequel purposes, you know.
I kind of appreciate that about movies that are willing to take that leap and kill off your main character at the end or whatever it is. Like, they don't make it. Like, the person you think's going to make it doesn't make it. When they kind of, like, take that trope and turn it on its head.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of fun.
I mean, even Psycho, like, one of the things that was so shocking about Psycho was the fact that the main character, quote-unquote, was killed.
Yeah.
But she was a thief. Mm-hmm. She was a liar.
Yeah.
She was, she wasn't an adulteress, I don't think.
No,
they weren't married, but she was a loose woman. She was a woman of
questionable
morals.
Yeah.
So now we watch this woman who society sneers upon in polite society, and all of a sudden she's murdered, and we're horrified. Like, that alone twists the societal norms on their ear.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times in horror movies, the heroes aren't really heroic. There's plenty of flawed and fallen heroes in them.
1960, Peeping Tom... Michael Powell of Powell and Pressburger. He was known for doing movies like The Red Shoes. Very artful, kind of really artistic and very well regarded films. And then he came out and did this movie that came out right around the same time as Psycho did, and was similar in content. And it's kind of really unusual take on serial killer and that kind of thing. Like, did something that nobody ever done before, and it ruined his career.
Mm.
Absolutely ruined his career. Because it was way ahead of its time.
It was too... Yeah, I was just going to ask why. It was too far, too fast?
It was violent. It was lascivious. It was very sexualized.
Yeah.
You know. But it's compelling. It's very well done. It's one of Scorsese's favorite movies. He's a huge fan of it. It was one of the first movies to do that kind of like POV kill. Because the whole thing of the character is like he uses... he has a special like... rod on the end of his camera that he murders people with. Like, he'll lure these women into his apartment to photograph them or whatever it is, and he winds up murdering them with this special camera that he's got. And it's very lurid and very well done. Really, again, atmospheric, very smartly done, well set up. You know, an accomplished director in his own
right,
long before he started dabbling in this kind of material, and it ruined him.
Yeah.
Absolutely ruined him. But it's fantastic if you can find it.
Did he ever come back?
I don't know if he ever really recovered from that.
Wow.
It's unfortunate. Because it's a stellar movie.
It is. I mean, that's another story for another time. But I mean, they killed Pasolini over Salo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, he literally was assassinated or, you know, murdered over making 120 Days of Sodom because it was well, too shocking.
He had a lot of political problems too, didn't he? Wasn't he very active in Italian politics and stuff like that? He was very...
Yeah, yeah, but...
That was part of the reason why
absolutely, and that didn't help, but also, I mean, Salo did shock... I mean, still shocks, quite frankly.
Salo is another... It's a horror movie, but not really a horror movie.
It's conceptually very frightening. I mean, yeah, but it's also... It also is... I mean, Salo is the type of movie that comes with a real warning. It's beyond, and it's, I think it, I don't know what its rating is, if it has one. I think it should be an X.
I think it got an X when it came, if it was ever released. I think it's officially now an NC-17.
It should, I think it should be an X. I think it's worse than NC-17. I've seen it twice. I'm not sure I will see it a third time.
I've only ever seen it once, and that was more than enough. It's in my library. I own it.
If anybody wants to know why, you can...
If you're curious, feel
free to check it out. It is let's say the first shocking thing that happens is a bunch of people are taken as human sex slaves, and the first act is a girl is shoved onto a tray of broken glass and raped in front of a bunch of soldiers, and that's how it starts.
Yeah, that's just the beginning. The movie's 2 hours long.
So it's based on the Marquis de Sade novel, 120 Days of Sodom. It's upgraded to aristocrats knowing the Allies are coming. They're in Italy, and they know the Allies are coming, so they are going to go out with as depraved a bang as possible.
Depraved is the word for it.
Yeah, it's chilling.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not even the right word. I mean, it is a deeply disturbing film. That's not even one where you watch and you're scared. You watch and you think about what kind of world and life people live in, which maybe is one of the points of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing we never really touched on is... horrifying movies that aren't necessarily horror movies,
right?
Is something to talk about. I mean, Salo is definitely one of them. There's a movie.
I mean, it is a piece of art. I mean, Salo is a piece of art, and there's definitely a point to it. And there is actually stories of love and affection and tenderness that has come out of this depravity. But Jesus, the journey you go on.
Yeah, seriously.
You watch Midnight Express to cheer yourself up after watching Salo, you know?
Like, but again, Midnight Express falls into that, I'm talking about. It's like, there's horrifying things, like things that are terrifying in that movie, but it's not known as a horror film.
Right.
It's known as a thriller or whatever you want to call it. I feel like that's almost a whole subgenre unto itself. They're like, I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, Irreversible, the French film.
No.
Monica Bellucci. It's told backwards. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the convention to it. But it's about a woman who, it boils down to a woman who gets raped on the subway while she's on her way to a birthday party. And it is one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen.
Yeah, Jesus.
Because it is absolutely unrelenting in its depiction. And it's not something that I necessarily recommend unless you want, it's hard to recommend.
Yeah.
It's an excellent movie because it pulls out a very visceral reaction, but it's not pleasant to see.
So why is, and we'll wrap up with this, why is it more fun to watch The Exorcist? You know what I mean? Like,
there's something it's the supernatural element to it. It's something that you feel like...
Or a Halloween, or a horror movie. Like, what makes that genre, which it still has, the funny thing about it is, we're talking about people getting killed. You know, Halloween opens with the little kid killing his sister. I mean, these are horrible, horrible things when we talk about them in a serious sense.
Yeah.
But there is something about the horror genre that makes it sort of palatable.
I think it's because they're relatable horrors. Like when you're talking about Halloween or something like The Strangers or whatever. It's like it's relatable on a certain level. You can see how it's terrifying. Or The Exorcist even. It's like you can kind of conceptualize how it could happen, but it doesn't feel like it's likely to happen.
Yeah.
But something like, say, Irreversible – or anything that's where there was a rash of movies like in the mid to late 70s where of rape revenge films where
like The Burning Bed and Extremities,
that kind of thing, like Miss 45, Abel Ferrara's movie. It's like there were a lot of Rape Squad. There's a movie actually called Rape Squad where the whole conceit of the movie is a woman or women being raped and taking revenge on their on the people that assaulted them. I mean, I Spit on Your Grave, that kind of thing. They're not necessarily horror movies, but they have a horrifying thing in it.
Yeah.
And I think they're very relevant today with the rape culture that we kind of exist in now. There's a lot of talk about that online, which rightfully so. I mean, there needs to be a lot of awareness about it in the society. There needs to be a big societal change, and as far as that is concerned.
Absolutely.
But I think something like that, where something that feels very real, those movies I think would have more of an impact. Because it feels like that's something that really could happen. There's, walking down the street or at a party or wherever you are.
There's a threshold to it, too. It's funny, and it's almost like this thing of, like, I could watch The Fly, but I'll never watch The Fly 2 again. Because of what they do to the dog. And there's something about, there's a weird thing about that of, like, I could watch a movie where, like, 50, 60 people get shot and killed, but I don't know if I could watch a movie where that's the denouement, where that's the big climax, or that's the moment of the movie is a very legitimate filmed rape. That's a hard, I don't know, there's like the lack of separation there. Like, all of a sudden, it's too raw. It's too...
It's too real. It's too realistic.
Too realistic, yeah.
But that is, that's part of what makes it horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, and it's not something for everybody. And there was, I haven't seen it. Serbian film is another movie that's very notorious. It has to do with child abuse and sexual abuse and this and the other. And it's been derided. It's like, it's been banned in most countries in the world. You can't really see it unless it's in a truncated version. But nobody was actually harmed. They used, you know, none of the actors were, you know, underage or anything like that. But it deals with a very real and very sensitive topic of child abuse and sex abuse, which is inherently horrifying.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that to happen. I don't care if you're a parent or not. Nobody ever wants to have that happen. And nobody's going to – that audience for that kind of movie is really small.
Well, and well, that's a great point, because I could watch The Exorcist every day, but it's not going to chill me as much as the Stephen Collins audio from TMZ.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, listening to just the way – And it's him.
Yeah,
it's him. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? What the fuck are you doing,
man? And he admits to doing terrible, terrible things.
Terrible things. And it's, and let's, he obviously is very, very ill. He's obviously a very ill man and stuff. Yeah, there is an interesting thing there of that crossing that line.
Yeah, there's
from horror to horrifying.
Yeah, there's absolutely
from horror, terrifying and suspense to trauma.
Yeah.
You know, I think Hitchcock actually crossed that with Frenzy.
Yeah,
like, Frenzy in many ways is like, that's
Frenzy,
like, what
again,
the fuck?
Another rape movie.
Yeah.
Rape movie.
Yeah.
In the early 70s. I don't know how it was about that era where rape was a thing that people would put on screen all the goddamn time. There are countless movies that were made in the 70s and early 80s where women are getting raped left and right, and I don't get it. I don't know what the hell the... I don't know what was going on in society that I can pinpoint where that was like... It encompasses an entire subgenre of movie making.
I think that's when a lot of awareness was happening. Because even nowadays, like, I've read some conservative thoughts on rape and stuff like that, and not to get on too much of a political band, I'm like, you don't even know what the hell rape is. And you're sitting here talking about, well, you know, Todd Akin, this fucking asshole, comes out, well, if it's a legitimate rape, well, this fucking schmuck. And the thing is, imagine what that viewpoint was like in the 70s, in the early 70s. It was, so I think there was like a new awareness.
Yeah.
Of what was this horrendous, horrible thing, and this new understanding of what was happening after suffrage, after women's life, after the liberalization of America and the arts, that was like, wait a second, we got to talk about this thing.
Yeah, but I mean, to its there's a detrimental side effect to that, though, where it was more aware of the public eye, but it was taken as something that was used by exploitation filmmakers and stuff like that to kind of like sell tickets.
Yeah, and that's well.
Which, you know...
That's not good either. That's not good either. But we do need powerful filmmaking, though. We do need strong filmmaking. Filmmaking, I think, has to be a place of bravery. I think filmmakers have to tackle that stuff and have to... maybe not me, maybe not you, but at the same time, I don't know. I mean, like, I wrote a script that in which a girl was raped, and it was one of those things where there was a lot of thought went into it and a lot of, like, okay... You know, what, how, why, and all the motivations and all the things that go into it, and it doesn't make it a better story. Well, you have to handle it honestly.
Yeah.
If you're going to make that decision, you cannot half-ass it and you cannot soften it.
Yeah.
You have to show it hurts. You have to show this is traumatic. You have to show that this is a horrible, horrible thing that is going to affect this character some way. Filmmaking and storytelling has to tackle that stuff, I think, bravely.
Yeah.
And... So did we. My goodness. So anyway, well...
That's a hell of a note to end on. Huh?
Absolutely. The
rape revenge topic.
And you didn't even bring up Better Every Day.
Oh, Trouble Every Day?
Trouble Every Day, which I still... The fact that you're so grossed out by that movie, I don't think I can see it.
I went to go see that at the... What is now the Sunset... the Sundance Cinema in Hollywood. It was the Sunset 5 back in the day. There you had a warning at the box office. when you went to go see that. It's like they had like they were only showing it at midnight. It was like they had one
showing
showing a day, and they had a warning at the box office like there are no refunds if you walk out. You don't get your money back. I mean, it was intense. It's like sitting through that. I was like, there's one thing that happens in that movie that I went, oh god, and turned away. I don't flinch at things.
No, you don't.
And it started, whatever, I'm not going to say what it is because it'll gross out your listeners. And if you really need to see it, you should seek it out. It's fairly readily available on video now, I think. It was a hard, there was a time where you, if you wanted to see it, you had to import it from the UK or something like that. But
I don't know. I think I'll watch Halloween again.
You know what might be fun to watch is the producer's cut of Halloween 6, which just came out on DVD.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's only available on the big.
Oh, no shit.
Halloween collection that Shout Factory just put out, but it's still not a great movie,
right?
But it's a hell of a lot better than it used to be,
yeah.
And it's still an interesting experiment. It's still interesting to watch, especially when you listen to the interviews that they did with the producer and some of the cast and whatever, and after the fact about what all the machinations that went into making it and the the cuts that were circulating on VHS.
Now, that's the one with Paul Rudd as Tommy, right?
Yeah, that was Paul Rudd's first feature film, as a matter of fact.
And what I like about that, the director and Donald Pleasance apparently didn't get along.
Yeah.
And when Pleasance passed away, the cast banded together in some way. I don't know if they talk about this in the special features, but they banded together and said, if he does not get a dedication to the movie, we're not shooting anymore.
Yeah.
And they held the director up. And because the director apparently was like, ding dong, the witch is dead. And the cast was like, oh no, pal.
Yeah, not a chance.
And so good on them, because Donald Pleasance absolutely deserved it, whether he got along with the director or not. His catalog of films, he can be a little uppity at the end there. I don't care.
Well, oops.
And something tells me he wasn't, based on the number of films he did and the number of directors he worked with. I have a sneaking suspicion it wasn't Donald.
Yeah, it was probably the sort of first-time director that they hired to direct that movie.
Yeah. All right, well, let's let the listeners go, because you and I will talk about this stuff all night. So maybe we'll do a part two.
Intense movies and things.
We'll see what people say. So
we can come back around Christmas time and do happy movies.
Yeah, maybe we'll do Christmas movies. I would love movies. Yeah, I'm looking at the calendar for that. We've got to start thinking that soon. So
it's a little outside my purview, but I see what I can do.
So let's say for sure you got a big long list of movies. If you do look up Solo or Trouble Every Day, they come with warnings. These are intense movies.
As does Inside, which I mentioned earlier, that French film.
As does
Martyrs. Actually, a lot of the movies I mentioned should come with warnings.
These are scary movies.
A lot of the things I mentioned are not for the faint of heart. I wanted to bring up Michael Haneke's Funny Games, too, as we were talking about home invasion movies and things that are terrifying but are not necessarily horror movies. Fucking hell, Funny Games. Jesus Christ.
So there's another one.
There's another
one. So if you want to get scared this weekend, enjoy Halloween. We just gave you a big, long list. So we got a lot more fun stuff coming up in November. And then, yes, we will be doing holiday programming in December. So look forward to that. Thanks, everyone, for reading, listening, downloading, sharing, retweeting. Wicked appreciate it. As long as you guys keep enjoying it, I'm going to keep recording it. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.